Number two, does everybody have a handout? If you don't, there are handouts on the empty chairs. The second is, they found in neuroscience studies that when you have a sad thought or an anxious thought or a mad thought, this creates an outpouring into your system of cortisol. Cortisol is the stress hormone, and over time it creates a toxicity to our tissues. And it also, in the short term, makes you feel bad. When cortisol is spurting through your body, it really makes you feel bad in mind and in body. So the work in joy producing is to, when your thoughts come up, you can't stop the negative thoughts because they're just programmed in us for survival to have a negativity bias. But what can you do to challenge them? To say, is that really true? Do I have evidence to the contrary? Is there anything I can do about it? Can I evolve? Can I change? Can I address the situation in some way? So you change that negative thought, which is more hopeless, more of a victim, to more of a solution-based thought. So then you shift into a goal, an exciting adventure, a intriguing aspiration. What can I do? What are my steps to achieve this aspiration? So, for example, the woman who organized the march of over 3 million people yesterday, it originated by, she woke up in the morning after finding out that Trump had won, and she was so depressed and so anxious and so hopeless that she was immobilized. And then an idea came into her mind. We need to organize people. We need to get people out into the streets. We need to challenge this. We need to use the people's energy to make their protests known. So she started organizing this march. And it gathered momentum and got people excited. And look what happened yesterday. So it's that shifting your thinking from, this is so horrible, this is overwhelming me, this is consuming me with worry, to what can I do to solve this problem? So then you shift into a different mode. So the goal-oriented mode or the aspiration mode is the mode that surges dopamine. Dopamine, you remember, is a joy biochemical, and it surges in us when we get excited about a project, when we start thinking about, oh, what I really want to do is write a book on this, or I want to organize people to change the situation, or I want to build a house, or I want to get ready to travel around the world, and I need to prepare. So all of a sudden, everything gets mobilized, and you get excited, and it surges dopamine. So dopamine always happens when you see a goal and you're taking steps to move toward it. Doesn't necessarily happen when you actually have gotten the goal, but it's moving toward it that causes dopamine. So you're shifting from a thought that produces cortisol, which makes you feel bad and eventually makes you depressed, to a thought that is surging dopamine and getting you excited and solving a problem. Does that make sense? Does everybody get that? Yeah. So, you're not really asked to make up a thought that isn't true. It's looking at a situation and seeing each situation as a spectrum. And I can either tune in to how horrible it is, how anxiety-provoking, how I'm helpless, or I can tune into possibility thinking, potential thinking. So all of those things are true. Nobody's asking you to come up with sort of a Pollyanna wishful thinking approach. It's more of, what aspect of this situation would I like to focus on and give my energy to? So you're infusing your mind with constructive thought, which produces all the joy biochemicals, which produce energy for you to change the situation. So not only does that change the immediate situation, but it also lays down new neural pathways of not thinking negatively all the time, not going to the worst case scenario, but you tend to set down a new habit of thinking, which tends to go to the constructive thought. What can I do to change this? Then it becomes more automatic. Once you have a neural pathway established by you repeating it over and over, always going to the constructive thought, how can I solve this problem? Then that becomes an etched-in manner of response. And then you'll do it automatically. So we have learned from neuroscience studies and many scientific machines which measure your body's physiological response to your thoughts. One of them is the lie detector, the polygraph machine. The other is biofeedback machines and many other scientific machines which measure physiological response to certain thoughts. So here's what happens when you have a negative thought, you know, of say, I'm angry, I'm hopeless, I'm a victim, I hate this situation, I'm sad, I'm anxious. Anytime you have a negative thought like that, your physiology changes immediately. And this is what happens. Your whole body's muscular system tenses up. All your muscles tense. Then your heart rate goes up, and it goes up to a very unhealthy level. And then your veins and arteries constrict, which restricts blood flow. The organs don't get the blood they need. The brain doesn't get the blood it needs. And your blood pressure increases. And then your joy biochemicals dramatically decrease. They go, and they don't output anymore. And then there's a total surging into your system of cortisol, which makes you feel down. And so we see, do I want to do this to myself? Once I realized the incredible load I was putting on my body by having all those natural negative thoughts, I said, I don't want to kill myself like that. I don't want to create this physiology. And also, neuroscience has found that our thoughts lie to us a lot. We have a built-in primitive alarm system so that we could survive out in the savannah. And that makes situations out to be much worse than they really are, which is really interesting. It's like we're perceiving incorrectly. And so knowing that your thoughts lie, there is a challenging that we can do. A stopping, a pausing, and debating with your thoughts. Actually calling them out and asking for their rebuttal. And so the way you do this is when you have negative thoughts, you write them down. Just write them down in the stream of consciousness. And then next to each one, you write the rebuttal. It's like you're talking back to your teenager. You say, but, da-da-da-da, but, da-da-da-da. So after a while, you're changing your neural pathways so your thoughts won't do this so much. So you're turning your problems into goals and goals into steps. And that produces dopamine, joy, rather than cortisol. One study I read, yes?
Can you
I will come back to you. That's a really good point. So last night I read a study. What happens when you worry? And I was going through this thing for a while, worrying about my daughter. I don't know if any of you have gone through this, worrying about your children, worrying about your parent, worrying about situation in the world. So for me, it was natural. I think it's natural for parents and people who are concerned to worry. It's an instant kind of knee-jerk reaction. So then I found out what worry causes in my body. So neuroscientists have found that it causes serious decrease in activity in two key brain areas. The first is the cerebellum. Worry completely shuts down your cerebellum. I wasn't really interested in having my cerebellum shut down. So what happens when your cerebellum shuts down? You don't integrate new information. In other words, new solutions can't come, new ideas, new possible ways of looking at this. And we can't think our way out of problems. We can't process information, or we do so very, very slowly and erroneously, and we get confused more easily. Isn't that interesting? Wouldn't that make you want to stop worrying right away? So the second thing it does is that greatly reduces activity in your temporal lobes right here. And that creates lowered mood, leads to depression over time, and poor memory. So these negative thought patterns also condition the brain to repeat that way of thinking over and over again. So you will automatically repeat it next time. Next time there's something that bothers you, you immediately go into worry. So then they measured gratitude thoughts. So when you can shift the worry into gratitude, all of the areas of the brain have better functioning, higher functioning. Your prefrontal cortex starts shining, and you can think of new ideas. But in order for that to happen, you have to be relaxed. And they found gratitude leads to calm, which I thought was interesting. So you're more apt to think of a solution to a problem if you're not worrying. And we think, well, I have to worry about this because it's such a serious problem. And if I don't worry, that problem will just go on. But actually, you'll think of more and better solutions and be more effective in carrying them out if you're in a state of gratitude and calm relaxation, which is... it's hard to remind yourself of that in the middle of the night at 3 in the morning and your teenager is not home. So, but it's so important, so important. So that leads to the third, which is avoiding rumination. Does anybody know what rumination is? I had a real predilection toward rumination, which is like really chewing over it, you know, just can't get that out of your mind, and then it creates this downward spiral. Oh, that's going to happen, and that's going to happen, and that's going to happen, and then your cortisol is just spurting out, and you're disempowered, really, to deal with the situation. So what's the solution? Neuroscience says shift, get up, physically get up from the situation, go to another room, and do something extremely engaging that really involves your mind. It captivates your mind, like an inspiring film or a really interesting book or talking to someone, your friend on the phone. What you need to do is change the channel in your brain so your brain can get really locked onto something. So, you cultivate that ability to shift your channel. And that's been immensely helpful for me. So when I wake up and I start worrying, I get up and I go into the living room, turn on the heat, make a cup of tea, and I start reading a really inspiring book and writing. So doing something physical is really helpful for concentrating. So they say, by all means, don't allow yourself to sit and ruminate, because that's the worst thing you can do for yourself. Okay, number four is this is very, very big, and of all the methods that neuroscience found, this was the one that came up over and over to be the key to joy, and that's to cultivate and nurture your relationships. Studies show that having good relationships is one of the biggest predictors of your joy. Human contact is a powerful joy creator and healer, and don't isolate yourself. And this one was particularly new for me. My job is as a professor, teaching world religions and constantly preparing, giving lectures, meeting with students, working as a therapist. It didn't really lend itself to having a lot of time to call up friends and say, hey, let's get together for lunch. So I tended to neglect my friendships. But after I read the studies in how important social connection was and being with people and having meaningful contact, then I started reaching out and I started making time for friends, making time, calling people up actually and saying, let's go for a walk together and let's go out to lunch. And I never did that before. I was too busy. And I really could tell you it made such a difference in my happiness level. So I encourage you all to think of ways, how can I increase my contact with people, my relationships? And this is not just superficial conversation. This is really having meaningful contact. So the World Health Organization states that social connections are more in healing than the most advanced pharmaceuticals. The key to happiness is to slow down and to connect. So it's recognized by the World Health Organization. Neuroscience says, why is this? Why are relationships so important? Because they flood your body with oxytocin, which is a joy biochemical. And that happens when you're with your friends and when you're with your lover. It happens when you're with your child, mother and baby. It happens whenever there is a deep contact between people, also during touch and massage. So you can understand that this was needed for our survival, right? We needed to band together with other people. Otherwise, we couldn't survive if we were alone. So it's built into us to need connections with other people, to need relationships. And whenever you need something for survival, it's connected with a joy biochemical. So when you have meaningful connection with people, then you get flooded with oxytocin, with a joy biochemical. It kind of says to you, I'm safe. I'm not going to be overrun by that tiger. We can work together to build shelter, to find food, and we won't be overwhelmed by this threatening environment. So we still have that conditioning, even though that's not the case anymore. But we do need other people. So studies have shown that people who are isolated actually have an excess of cortisol in their bodies. So cortisol is the stress hormone and leads to depression eventually. So I didn't even realize that. You know, I was thinking that my isolation, my working constantly, preparing and doing all those things, that it was fine. It didn't matter. But actually, it's a missing piece to not have close relationships that you see frequently in your life. So those who have strong social ties have much lower levels of stress hormones, cortisol. And they generally have good physical and emotional health, and they have a great ability to cope with stress. So all those things are telling us this is one factor. You know, it takes effort, right, to nurture relationships. It took effort for me to, you know, make those things happen in already a busy schedule. But the rewards were tremendous. Okay, number five. This is practicing acts of kindness and compassion. Usually we think, oh, if I have to do an act of kindness, I have to pick up somebody, take them to the doctor, if I have to, you know, extend myself to help an elder and take her somewhere and do something, do some errands. It takes from me. This is like a burden or something I don't have extra time for. But actually what they found is when you do some act of kindness or compassion, your left prefrontal cortex lights up like a Christmas tree. Isn't that interesting? Built into us for survival. We needed to be doing kind things for each other in order to survive. So they did this one experiment where they gave each person in the study $20. And they said, okay, go out and find somebody who's really in need and give them this $20. And so they measured the lighting up of the left prefrontal cortex of the person who got the $20. And of course it was, you know, lighting up like Christmas tree, like someone just gave me $20 and I really need it. So then they measured the person who was the giver of the $20. And their left prefrontal cortex was lighting up just as much as the person who received. So then we know this is one of the keys to our joy, is making that extension of ourselves to be able to help another person. So it's not just a religious thing of you should really help your neighbors. It is a biological need that produces this joy biochemicals. Number six, cultivating appreciation. Hundreds of studies have been done on this and the fact that gratitude, appreciation, thankfulness raises your level of joy biochemicals and lights up your left prefrontal cortex. So if you're in a place where you're just feeling kind of down or you're tired, you can immediately switch on more joy and more energy by switching to, what in my field now can I appreciate? And that becomes your little tool for getting through the day. So across the country, in Psychology 101 classes, in which there are 600 people, they would divide the class into three groups. One group was 200 people. Their assignment was, at the end of the day, I want you to write down the key things that happened to you, the good and the bad. The second group of 200 people, at the end of the day, we want you to write down the hassles, the obstacles, the difficulties. And the third group of people, we want you to write down the good things that happened to you. A friend helped me with my homework. It was a beautiful sunny day and I took a walk. I met a friend for tea. So, simple things. So what happened? I'm going to compare the gratitude group with the other two groups, the hassles group and the positive and negative reporting group. Okay, this is what happened to the gratitude group over time, who wrote down every day five things they were grateful for. That's all they did. Compared to the other two groups, they experienced far fewer symptoms of physical illness. They had more energy and vitality. They had less stress and depression. They rated their life far more favorably. And they reported better well-being appraisals. They had more optimism. They took better care of themselves. They ate better and they did a lot more exercise. They slept better, longer and deeper, and woke more refreshed. They had higher ratings of happiness. They were more likely to help someone. They were more connected with others and less isolated. They reported that they felt loved. Why? Because they actually noticed the nice things that people were doing for them. They had more attentiveness. They had kind of an alert awareness. They had more determination to, you know, get the schoolwork done or whatever goals they had. They had more enthusiasm, more strength, more excitement, and calm. So we can see there are all kinds of physical, psychological, and spiritual advantages to just shifting to that way of thinking. And it can become a powerful tool. When I was committed to do my new program of taking dance classes every day, someone gave me a week's membership at the Claremont Hotel. And they have thousands of dance classes every week. And it's such a beautiful place. It was like paradise. And so I would go there every day. And I noticed that, you know, I'm walking through these beautiful flower gardens to get from the parking lot to the club. And beautiful flower gardens and gorgeous, majestic architecture and splendiferous towers against blue skies and palm trees and fields of grass and beautiful views. And I feel like a kid, you know, at the circus. Just in awe. Yet the people who belonged there and went there every day, you know, every one of them was in front of their smartphone, walking, didn't see a thing, walking up from the parking lot to the place and down, missing this whole thing. So not to put them down, we all do that with accommodation, with habituation. You know, you don't even notice anymore the beautiful things in your life. So I would just encourage each one of us to open those eyes again of wonder, of taking in the incredible beauty and amazing things that you have in your life, but you're not really tuning into them. That part of your perception has sort of gone dormant, but it really made a difference in my happiness level. By the time I walked up that hill from the parking lot, I was really happy. So it really, I could feel it make a difference. So this appreciation needs to be extended to yourself, and that's the next one. What happens when you start appreciating yourself? When, like, for example, what I would do with this is after I would finish like a really hard dance class and I could barely get through it and I'm so out of shape, I would say to myself, wow, look what you did. You know, even though it was so hard, even though you're not very good at this, you did it. I'm really proud of you. You know, and instead of just going on and sort of staying with those ideas of like how uncoordinated I am and how I don't know the steps and I'm, you know, really not very good at this at all, that all produces cortisol. All that makes you feel bad, takes your energy, leads you to be depressed. But this idea of taking a moment and saying, look what I did. Look what I did. You know, that was great. It was really wonderful. If you help somebody, instead of just going on to the next thing, you stop and say, wow, that was really great that I did that. And instead of this being arrogant or pompous, it's actually a need of our body and mind to feel appreciated and respected. This is also built into us because it was the person in the tribe that was respected that for sure got the right mate, got the right food sources. If you had self-esteem, if you had high esteem in the tribe, you were ensured survival. So we still have that programmed into us. We actually need respect. We need esteem. It's not something that it's vainglory. It's actually a basic need. But if I'm going to wait until you express your appreciation for me, it may never happen. Right? Because people are, you know, they're concerned with their own world and they don't think so much about saying, wow, great job. So you have to give it yourself. You have to be the one that says, that was amazing what you did. And I, even if it wasn't amazing, look at the effort you put out. Sometimes that's all they do. You put out the effort, and that's really great. So this is a way that you can surge dopamine and serotonin in your body and set up dopamine circuits and serotonin circuits to then further automatically lead to the flooding your body of dopamine and serotonin. So anytime you're self-critical or you put yourself down, that is considered by your body and mind to be a threat. And you produce cortisol. The amygdala gets aroused. There's alarm. And so you don't want to do that to yourself. And yet we have been raised with self-deprecation. That was a way that we were motivated in school and at home, but it's actually counterproductive. What really motivates us is to be filled with dopamine and serotonin and be inspired by, you know, the fact that you're doing well. So you have to do it for yourself. And that takes overcoming our conditioning. But if you know, if I give myself honor and credit for what I did, or even a good thought, I mean, it could start really small, then I know I'm going to flood myself with the 7 joy biochemicals. I know I'm going to light up my left prefrontal cortex. I know I'm going to be happy. I'll have more energy to give to other people. So you can inspire yourself in that way to get over your conditioning. One thing is to look for one small victory every day. Like it could be, I ate really well today. And then instead of just ignoring it and moving on, you praise yourself. And you might even write it down. Anytime you write something down, it etches it into the brain and you tend to remember it more. So it has a bigger impact. So you actually have a need, a physiological, psychological need to applaud yourself. And this raises your serotonin and dopamine to very, very high levels. The mammal brain is wired to long for security that self-esteem brings. It meant survival and passing on of your genes. So when you are congratulatory to yourself, you will notice this part of you that goes, oh, it's not really true, that's not such a big deal, why are you going to, you know, this trouble to praise yourself for this. That's your old neural circuits, and it berates you. And this is taking from you. This is disempowering you. So it's releasing cortisol, and it's reducing your mood. And so if you unconsciously set about to you will unconsciously set about to prove these self-deprecating thoughts in your behavior. So if you're thinking self-deprecating thoughts like, oh, I'm such a klutz, I can't do this dance like everybody else in this class, that sets up unconsciously a program that you will continue in your klutz-like behavior. So instead, you shift it to, my aspiration. Step by step, I'm going to improve. And that arouses dopamine. Then your body goes, okay, we're on a goal. We're on a mission. This is just a training program. Doesn't matter if you're not doing well. This is just the beginning. And you get excited. So then you get surges of dopamine and serotonin. So it's really cultivating this boundary. I'm setting a boundary line between my habit of thinking negative things about me and my life. I'm protecting my life. I'm protecting my happiness. And you kind of have to be a warrior for your happiness, because your old programming is going to consciously kick in and disempower you with the negative thoughts about yourself. So it's like rising up and saying, no, I'm not allowing that to happen. Okay, number 8 is learning to savor. This is one of my favorite ones. So you're really not changing your situation. You're just opening up that faculty of really getting into it. Just absorbing yourself in it. Immersing yourself in the experience. So, for example, I could walk out of here and I could just go to my car, but you know, it's been raining for 3 weeks and the sun's out and there's diamonds on every leaf. And if I just walk past that, I am blowing my chance to have a booster for serotonin and dopamine. I'm just completely saying, no, I don't want that joy. No, So it's just taking life as is. You don't have to change your husband or your job or, you know, you just as is. You're just opening your eyes, your ears, your sense. So there's 3 aspects in savoring. The first is noticing. Noticing. Even attending. A lot of people won't even see those diamonds on every leaf. They'll just go right by. See, taking the time to notice. Notice an expression on someone's face. Notice a feeling in the room. Notice what happens to you after you eat certain foods. Notice the effect of music on you. All these things we're not even paying attention to. So the second is to appreciate it. To allow it to come in and have that sense of, you know, savoring a bath. Savoring a cup of tea. The third is to enhance it. So not just the normal, regular, but really allow it to become bigger, to magnify. So you're generating thoughts and you're intensifying them, and then you're prolonging the positive feelings in response to your experience. So, say for example, for me, after the dance class, even though I was really uncoordinated, I didn't know the steps, I was feeling bad, I'd go outside and I'd have the sense of, I felt great. The dopamine was surging. The serotonin was surging. The norepinephrine was surging. So if I hadn't taken that, and all it is a moment to notice, then I would have missed the opportunity for joy. So it's really cultivating that mindfulness to be in the present moment and not to miss your life. All these experiences are given to us to increase our joy, yet we're missing them. And we were just talking before class about this woman traveling all around the world. Travel is a wonderful way to increase your savoring, because everything's new, everything's fresh, and you have this sense of being present with it, really delighting in it, relishing in it. So have that sense of you're new here. You know, this is the first time you've ever been in this experience, and have that, you know, sense of a childlike wonder and getting into it. So that's another aspect of the joy practices, which is the psychological state of flow. And this is something that athletes get into. It's a psychological state of complete absorption without self-consciousness. And something is a little bit challenging, but not so much that you're self-conscious, so you're anxious. And it is complete attention. You're giving yourself over to it. So artists often have this, writers have this, but you can have it too. And a happy life is marked by many flow experiences during the day where you're completely absorbed in what you're doing. And try that out and see what effect it has on you. It's really equate something. You have this experience. You can have it every day eating. Or you can do something that truly engages you and allow yourself to be completely drawn in to the experience. And it also leads to not only happiness, but greater health. The last one is to find your passion, find your meaning, find your goal. So when you move toward a goal, it releases surges of dopamine. So they found this in the savannah when a giraffe is just grazing. There's not really very much dopamine, but he sees a rabbit over there. And then he starts running toward the rabbit. And that's when the dopamine surges. So you find your rabbits during the day. Find those things that you can aspire to. And not like a heavy guilt-tripping goal. Like, oh, I didn't do that, I'm so bad. No, more something like, this is something I'm lifting myself up to because I love it. I want to. Could be, I really want to research an area. So what I did for this was, I was really interested in how does a person prevent cancer. So I committed every day studying for half an hour on research that has shown us how to prevent cancer. Because I had a lot of members of my family that had died of cancer. So I was inspired by it. And it became, now it's going to be a book. So, but it was a kind of a lifting force in my life. So you could say problems cause anxiety and cortisol, stress, tension. But you shift your problems into goals where it's like inspiring you to action and aspiration. So when you set the goals, then you write down your steps. And every day, take 10 minutes to do one of the steps. And then you kind of got a program for yourself. And they have found in neuroscience that we have free-floating anxiety. And that if a person has a goal or an aspiration, it actually prevents the free-floating anxiety from taking center stage because it's something that's like a guiding force in your life. It's overarching. It's something that's lifting you up above that free-floating anxiety. And then you can actually use that anxiety to fuel you into carrying out the steps. So how do you find your goal? Ask yourself, what really gets me excited? What am I drawn to? What am I intrigued by? What sparks my interest and my passion? What makes you come alive? So they found in studies of, they did a study on 1,000 happy people. They actually found 1,000 happy people. What did they all have in common? They had goals. One guy was building a boat. Another woman was planning her trip around the world. Another woman was really invested in homeschooling her kids. Another was very excited about doing research and writing a book. So you just think about, like, what excites me? What could I turn into a project? And it's not always remembering that it's not the fulfilling of the goal, the accomplishment, the end point that gives you the dopamine. This is really interesting. It's only the steps toward the goal that gives you the joy. So not to get down on yourself if you don't attain it. So you first start off and make the goal really easy. Why? Because you want to attain it. You want to have that feeling of accomplishment, and that gets the snowball rolling down the hill. Like, oh, I can do this, you know. I'm fueled up. So you make it really small, and then you can set another one. And then the second step is you information gather. like, how can I bring this about? And then you use that to make a plan, the step by step, making the steps really small. So you define these manageable steps, and the goal doesn't seem so overwhelming. It seems easy. Kind of draws you in. And each of those steps is 10 minutes. And then you're able to develop this habit making, really, of accomplishing an overwhelming task. So then you appreciate yourself for it. After you've accomplished something, even a 10-minute segment, you turn around and you go, look what I did. That was good. That was amazing. Good for you. Pat yourself on the back. And this gives you surges of dopamine and serotonin, which give you joy. So if you do this faithfully for 45 days, that's all it takes, 45 days, you develop a habit. And the habit's wired in. It's a neural network in your system. And automatically, it will produce the joy biochemicals over and over and over again. And you'll develop new goals that you'll apply it to. And the results are you're really training yourself to cultivate a life of joy. And it begins to feed on itself. And you share it with other people. And you also see your problems start to find solutions and come about in reality. So, any questions? It's a lot. Yes.
Okay, we're going to start right here. What is the evolutionary benefit of cortisol?
To get you out of there quick. If you're worried, you know, because a saber-toothed tiger might be in the bushes, the cortisol, it tenses your muscles so you can run. Gets your heart rate up so you can get out of there. The fight. Fight or flight.
But why have we evolved to ruminate? You know, why have we evolved to, you know, do all these, quote, negative things that drain us? You know,
yeah. We no longer have the saber-toothed tiger, and we're ruminating that there might be one in the bushes, or the storm might be coming, and we have to build a shelter to survive. But all of those threats are no longer here. So we have this just these wheels spinning inside, and they say now that our evolution as a human species, instead of going toward depression, which is increasing, we are going to learn these methods and stop that fight or flight over response, that primitive alarm system, when it's no longer needed. We're kind of adapting to a new situation.
I was wondering how you see meditation in relationship to the techniques you're talking about. Do they achieve the same things, or some of them?
Right. Yeah, we'll talk about that next time. That's one of the factors, spirituality, meditation, opening to something larger in yourself and outside. And meditation, there have been so many studies on meditation and producing happiness. And again, that's that calm alertness that produces the joy biochemicals. Yeah, a lot of evidence on that, and we'll definitely look at that next time.
Well, I heartily endorse all your suggestions, and I'd like to make one more, and that is wear pretty clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it's not so far off, because beauty is one of them. You know, being able to see beauty and give beauty to the world and feel like you are beauty, noticing beauty wherever you go. But we actually have a need for that, too. That gives us dopamine and serotonin. Yes. Yes.
So I want to add a couple of comments. This is something that's really, really important. Any negative thought produces cortisol.
Yeah.
I don't like it. And you're making your cortisol. So that's just a caution. And I want to add to meditation. You know, when you're talking about trying to deal with something, I do a lot of computer programming, and one of the best tools that I've found for solving, you know, I've got a question that I can't answer, is like to let go of it and meditate. So, I mean, I put it in that list of useful things to be able to do.
You put it in the category of letting it go for a while. Yeah, not... Yeah, that's. I think Einstein talked about that, and when he was really working on a conundrum, he would let it go and go for a walk and not think about it, and then all of a sudden the solution would come. I guess maybe it has something to do too with that rumination, how it really shuts down our new ideas, our new new information, new creativity, connecting different parts of the situation. Yeah. Thank you.
I just had a question about, you had the results of your gratitude study. How were those results measured? There was a lot of results.
Yeah. You should really go and look at the work. You can look it up online. It's in a book by Professor McKinnon, and he had well-being appraisals by yourself and your roommate and your friends, and then someone would interview you. And before the study, they had, you know, it was relatively equal in how what their diet was and exercise. So it wasn't as if these people were already pretty advanced in those areas. But it's such an interesting study, and it's been replicated over a 20-year period. Now it's done in every Psych 101 class. And every time it comes up with the same results. So I really recommend looking at it and looking at his book, Gratitude. What a great book. That will really change you. All the studies that have been done, the results, and how they appraised it. Yes?
Hi. You were speaking of the evolutionary development of cortisol as a protective mechanism, and that we don't have those same immediate threats anymore, but what we have are more global threats.
Yes.
Nuclear war, climate change, authoritarian leaders, etc.
Yes.
And it seems to make it where we don't know anymore the immediate response. We could, in the past, just run away or raise our spear or whatever. Now we have to face global threats which require larger interconnections, and they're harder to make. And do you have any reflections on that?
Right. It feels more overwhelming and less tangible, and therefore it can be more anxiety provoking. But the problem is that cortisol kind of disempowers you from being able to find a solution and have energy to be able to bring it about. Because when you're depressed and anxious, you don't have any energy. You're just depleted. And that's not really solving the problem. So you think about, like, what attitude is really going to solve the problem? And then you put a rein in on the cortisol activities. Okay, anybody else?
Yes.
Yes?
The approach that I took to happiness and joy was influenced by an Alan Watts book on, you know, he called happiness accepting, coming to accept whatever is. And I saw joy as something that doesn't come from what's around us and already is, but it comes from God,
mm-hmm.
fruit of the Holy Spirit. And then in hearing, happiness can be from, I'm thinking maybe what you're talking about of stimulating brain chemicals and neural reprogramming, that is a matter of accepting what is in a way that's very positive for us to respond and react with it. I'm trying to think of maybe, you know, certainly when we think about prayer and meditation and things that are spiritual, which are likely to connect back. I haven't resolved how all this fits together, but I just have those thoughts. So I wanted to
That's a really good point. Yeah. I guess the savoring would come in with that, that you are being in the present moment, you're accepting it, you're being with it completely, and you're appreciating it. And that leads to joy. And also this idea of being in the present moment, that has a huge amount of research around it. When you're thinking about the future and worrying, it tends to produce cortisol. And when you're regretting the past, it also produces cortisol. So this idea of being in the present is conducive to happiness. And a lot of studies support that. So we're going to also talk about that next time. And certainly the religions support what you're saying, you know, that it comes from the divine. But what about people that don't have that particular theology? How can we help them find joy? And is there something about the Holy Spirit being within us that we can tap into? And does it have to be separate from our physical nature, which is the joy biochemicals? Maybe that was placed in us, in our divine creation, to be able to have joy, and yet we're not tapping it. You know, it's sort of an unused resource. Sort of like if this church was really suffering from money and they really were struggling, and yet buried underneath this church was gold. And we didn't even know about it. So this is the buried gold inside of us that we can draw on for health and energy and happiness and calm. So I'm thinking a lot more and more about the idea of non-duality and how we often separate physical and spiritual. And maybe they are separate, but I'm just entertaining this idea and wondering, you know, why we have so many resources of joy inside of us. Maybe we're supposed to be cultivating them and using them. We're supposed to be walking around really in a state of contentment and well-being and upliftedness. So, yeah.
I was thinking about the self-appreciation aspect, and I was first thinking, okay, Donald Trump must really have this one down. And then I thought, well, maybe not.
Maybe not.
It's the opposite, because
maybe not.
He's getting his self-appreciation from the outside. It appears he has self-appreciation. But, yeah, so maybe we have to be careful that we're actually getting it from where it needs to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. And they have found with people that need to self-aggrandize and need to call attention to themselves, often they have an emptiness inside. They have a feeling of low self-esteem, and they're compensating. So what you're doing is not, you're filling up that empty hole, so that you're not going to have to compensate. Yeah. Yes?
I think the challenge comes in relationship. And I was so buoyed by the women's march yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Because so often women are critical of each other, especially
yeah.
in the workplace. We can be competitive.
Yes.
And it was so nice that we jiggled that pattern.
Yes.
I find so much that men need to be encouraged to interact with each other, and find that marriage is very much a challenge because the man is too much a homebody.
Uh-huh.
And all I can do, and all you're suggesting, is to be an example. But I really do think that men have to work on reaching out to each other.
Oh, yeah.
And let it not be a sports team, maybe, mm-hmm. or the army.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really good point, yeah. And it requires knowing how important it is to have relationships, and not to see relationships as competition or sort of empty talk, but really this is a need that's like food. That was a new one for me. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's also been a lot of research that shows that individuals have kind of like a set level of happiness, and that, you know, when an amputee, you know, is devastated at first, and then over time they return to the same level of happiness they had before they lost the limb, or a lottery winner is elated. but over time they return to the same level of happiness.
Yes.
That they, is there evidence that this, you know, like a 45-day program of this is kind of like a reset? That
yeah, that's
you
what you're doing. You're resetting it. You're getting, you're overcoming those wired-in neural pathways that are leading to cortisol output and negative, depressing thoughts. And your old way will encroach on you unless you intervene. And what I love about this program is that it puts the power in you. You can change your life. You can change the way you think. You can change your activities. And it will make a difference in your set point, your happiness set point. And it won't have to go back to your default level. It's like we can evolve.
Last question.
Yes, my initial question. Remember I asked about the gadgets to measure this level of negative intensity in your... What do they call that? Is there a...
Biofeedback and also polygraphs.
Oh, polygraphs.
Also. Yeah, so that's all measuring the physiological response.
Oh, where do you go for polygraph?
The police department. Yes? Yes. But it's not the whole deal. It's like 40% is genetic, your happiness. 10%, only 10% is your situation. That means your job, your husband, your children, all those things that we think are so important. They're only 10% of the cause of your happiness. 50% is your voluntary choices. This program can change that 50%. So we have that 50% to work with. It's a lot. It can really change things, yeah. So I would just like to ask each one of you to try some of these over the next week. And when you come back next week, I'd love to hear what you discovered. What, just use yourself as an experiment. Try certain things out and notice the effects. And then when we come back together next time, I'd really like to hear from you.
Thank you, honey.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to next week.